everybody. This is Phil Town.
And this is Danielle Town.
And welcome back to the Invested Podcast. We're on, if you're keeping count, I think we're on 252.
Are we?
Yeah.
I kept count to 250. And then after that, it's too many numbers.
It's a lot of numbers. We've been doing this a while, huh?
Yeah.
We're doing once a week. That would add up to about 5 years worth of podcasts. Can you believe we have 5 years worth of podcasts on here?
Well,
is that even possible?
It's not been 5 years. No, wait. We started in, I'm the worst at years. Did we start in 2016? No, we started in 2015. And now it's 2020. So it's been about four full years, right?
Four full years.
Like half of 2015.
That'd be a little over 200. We have 252. I think we're very, very, very close to 5 years worth here.
Yeah.
At 260. Aren't we at 5 years at 260? Yeah, we are. So that is unbelievable.
I've been talking
with you about investing for 5 years and you've gotten quite good at it. So everyone out there, take heart.
Yes, take heart. I agree with that. Should be our slogan. Just stop with all this explanation at the beginning. Welcome to the Invested Podcast. Take heart.
Oh my gosh.
You too can get over your block with numbers and deal with this craziness.
Your stepbrother just sent me a really cool thing from business school.
Oh, cool.
He sent over a business school chart that shows the standard deviation between having 1,000 stocks, 800, 700, 600, 500, 400, 300, 200, 100, 90, 80, 70, 60, 50, 40, 30, 20, like that. The standard deviation of returns, if I understand this correctly, and if you're an efficient market theorist, I'm sure you're going to shoot us an email about what I've screwed up on this, but it looks to me like the standard deviation of returns is almost identical. It's just slightly less standard deviation if you have 30 stocks or more than if you have 20 or 10.
Well, no, I'm lost. And okay. Admittedly, I'm not a statistician, but a standard deviation is a statistically significant separation of data from one area, one part of data to another. So you're saying there's a whole standard deviation between 30 stocks and 10 stocks?
It's like if you have 20 stocks, your standard deviation is around 20. And if you have like 1,000 stocks, it's like 19. In other words, you don't get any real benefit in terms of the idea of diversifying your portfolio. You don't get any real benefit much past 20 stocks. A 20 stock portfolio.
Okay, so that's not a standard deviation, but
it's a standard deviation of returns.
Okay, I think that's
using the term. Oh man, I hope you're not going to go deeper into this because I have just hit bottom of my lake.
I have two.
My lake is 2 inches deep on standard deviation.
I think it's a different term, but tell me the point of what you're getting at.
The point is it doesn't get you anything in terms of less risk by shifting from 20 stocks to 1,000.
Okay.
Or 30, or 40, or 50, or 60.
Wouldn't
or
it make an enormous difference which stocks you own?
Well, that's of course what they don't tell you.
How can they even put that into a statistic? That doesn't make any. I mean, people put things into statistics all the time, so I'm sure there's a way.
It is really a good question. I mean, if you have 1,000 stocks, you're gonna end up with a market return, because the S&P 500 is only 500 of them, so you're gonna end up with a market return. If you have 20 stocks, efficient market theory would suggest you'll have a much wider deviation from a market return than if you have 1,000. So 1,000 stocks should give you just exactly a market return with very little deviation.
Right.
And it turns out 1,000 stocks is going to give you only a slightly different amount of deviation from the market than 20 stocks will. In other words, 20 stocks will pretty much do the market.
There's just no way that's true.
What? Honey, are you listening? It's not true.
What if
your lawyer sister-in-law says it's, or stepsister says it's not true?
I don't know if he ran the numbers, but yeah, it depends which companies they are. Obviously.
I haven't actually seen the statistics before. This was a statistical chart, and I will get Hunter to weigh in here on this and find out more about this. But I have heard this before that if you have a reasonable 20 stock portfolio, it's not all in one industry or something, right?
Mm-hmm.
That you have all the diversification you can get from having 1,000 stock portfolio.
Yeah, I would agree with that. At least
90% of it.
Don't you think if you had like really diversified those 20 different stocks and really had them in different geographical areas and industries and different cycles, I could totally see somebody being able to do that with 20. Yeah.
And yeah, this isn't exactly proof because the indexes do change stocks when something gets out of when it's not doing well. But the Dow Jones Industrial Average is only 30 stocks, and it is my view of what the market's doing. And
true.
It works quite nicely. I mean,
true.
It works very, very well. It's acceptable to use the Dow Jones 30 stock index as a reasonable reasonable proxy for the market. So to say that, if you have 20, I think you're roughly within 90% of the same result. And if you have 10,
they're diversified,
here's the best part.
Yeah.
If you have 10 stocks, which is kind of where we are, we're more toward the 10 stock than the 20 stock, you have 80% of the same standard deviation. So you're going to be a little bit like 20% more volatility, assuming you have a diversified 10 stocks. And that might be very acceptable for most people to have a little more volatility than the stock market if the end result were to get a 20% return instead of a 7% return. See what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's crazy good news for investors that are thinking about taking this on, this do this rule one investing stuff and try to learn, the way Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger teach it best we can do that and end up with 10 stocks and maybe 20 in a lifetime.
I mean, the same point, like it really depends what the stocks are.
Well, yeah, of course. So, it depends on what the stocks are. But
I don't know. I struggle with these stats that are like with 20 stocks, you'll come up with this. Well, no, you won't. It depends on what they are. And if it's with 10 stocks, it's even more dependent on what
they
are.
Get there. What do they do? Take a random sampling of 20 stocks and then run the standard deviation on it and see what they came up with and just throw darts at 20 things?
Let's leave the standard deviation out of it. Because I do not think that word means what you think it means.
Well, let's say you're taking the beta out of it. I think that's really what they mean.
Yeah.
Is that how does this compare to the S&P 500 index?
Yeah, yeah.
In terms of its how much movement around it do you have,
mm-hmm.
and what's your rate of return relative mm-hmm. to the index? So
yeah, you're exactly
I don't
right.
know how you get there, but I do know this: if you're using your brain, you should come out at least as good as a broad random sample. At least as good. And if at least as good as a broad random sample is getting you the same level of volatility roughly as the market itself, then what's to worry about? Let's learn this stuff and go after that 20% return instead of being down here at 5%. I think it'd be pretty smart.
Well, the part to worry about is that you're not diversified. So those 10 stocks that you choose may turn out to be the bottom 10 instead of the top 10.
Well,
that's what I worry about.
If let's say you picked
'cause you're picking,
10
right?
Companies.
That's the point. We're getting an edge by picking, by choosing.
Right.
That's the concept here.
We're getting an edge.
So, equally, one must admit that the other side of that coin is the possibility that your picks are bad.
And you're basically saying that the edge has two sides to it. It's a two-edged sword. It can cut both ways.
Yeah,
it can
your edge
get you
could actually
returns.
Be your downfall. Yes.
Yeah, it can get you higher returns and lower returns. And I'll bet you that's what that standard deviation is talking about. It's the range of returns you'd get just randomly applying 20 stocks across the entire market over and over and over and over and over and over.
Yeah,
and over
probably. Yeah, because that's how statisticians do that sort of thing, which is how they come up with stuff like that.
You're going to have a bigger range than you would on the S&P 500. Now, the beauty of picking your own stuff, though, and just to get back to why we've done almost 5 years of podcasts about this stuff, is because the stock market doesn't just go up all the time, right? I mean, if you could say, oh, well, hey, I'm just going to put my money in the stock market and it'll make me an annuity-like return of 7% a year. Well, okay, that would be like having a bond. But the problem is the stock market doesn't do that. In fact, it does something radically different than that. It can go down 50%, back up to where it was, and keep doing that yo-yo without ever getting higher than it was. And it can do that for as long as, so far historically, 26 years.
Yeah, totally.
Which leads
yeah.
us Which to is... George Soros saying, hey, yeah, the stock market always goes up in the long run, but in the long run, we're all dead. Meaning you can't count on the stock market coming back.
That's funny.
super quickly. And it's so funny how the marketplace plays with this at CNBC and at your mutual fund advisors and all the whole thing is to maximize their desire to hold on to your money and maximize their ability to do so by giving you really bad statistical stuff. And the latest one that I just think is just financial pornography is these guys basically saying, look how great the stock market did in 2019. Isn't this amazing? What a rocket ship stock market we've had. It's just like freaking unbelievable how this stock market is exploding in 2019.
Okay.
Right? I mean, 28%?
Is huge. That what it did in 2019? I didn't know that. I never
Something
paid any attention.
Huge like that. Huge.
Right? I got to look it up.
having done this magnificent, wow, what a great thing to be in the stock market. These guys forgot that as of September of 2018, if you'd started there instead of a, you know, this sort of arbitrary time frame of 12 months, it happens to match the calendar, so let's just use it. Instead, if you'd started in September when the market peaked and then began to crumble down until it crashed all the way down in December, almost to the bottom perfectly by December 31st, if you'd started in September and calculated the rate of return of the S&P 500, it would be a compounded return over that 16-month period of about 4%.
Do you want to know what it actually was?
Was it?
In 2019, this is the S&P 500, mm-hmm. so that's using that as the marker. In 2019, returned 30.43%.
30.43.
And if you add in dividends, 33.07%.
33.07.
Oh my God. I did not know that.
Okay.
Wow.
So, and they're going to use this.
No
as
wonder
a,
everybody
every
with funds
financial
is
advisors
going nuts.
Out there. I mean, they're all using this now because, oh, look at how great the stock market is. And, you know, they forget that the market, let me see, the market peaked at just almost 3,000 on September 21st, 2018, right? And it got back to almost 3,000. Hang on. Got back there. Okay, right about July. Okay, so July of 2019, it broke even since September of 2018.
So, right, I think what you're saying is that the period you look at makes a big difference?
I'm saying that the financial industry is going to hype up the returns in the market every chance they get. And they're going to leave you baffled that your 401k hasn't improved 33%. Why not, I wonder?
I see.
We obviously had a 33% year. And the reason is because the market really was flat until November of 2019. Flat from September of 2018. It was a 0% rate of return. And then in the last 2 months of 2019, it mm-hmm. took off and went up about 300 points or about 10% overall. Hmm. So if you took that on a compounded rate of return, you'd be looking at about a year and a third at 10%. So I'm probably a little off there. It's probably like a 6% return compounded. Hmm. But my point is, it's nothing like a 33% return. Okay, like get a freaking grip. on what these people are actually telling you. So,
and yet it is a 33% return from the beginning of 2019 to the end of 2019.
Yeah. But that's like saying that from the beginning of, let's say, this is what I think really confuses people. Let's go back to,
I think it's pretty normal to use a calendar year as a reporting mechanism for time period.
Oh, totally, totally, totally reasonable to do that, but totally unreasonable to have absolute mental loss. You know, you can't remember anything. You have complete memory loss about what happened the year before. It would be a bit like saying that the market return in 2010 to 2011 was just a spectacular 25% return, having forgotten that you've lost half of your money in the previous 2 years, right? In other words, you need a 100% return just to get your money back. And you forgot that. And you're hyping up, look at how great the market's doing. It's up 25%. It's up 30%.
Oh, I see. So 20%. It's like, if you're in 1931 and you're like, the market's up, I don't know what happened in 1931, but if it's up 25% and you'd be like, well, but it's
I've lost 90% of my money.
Yeah, exactly. That's what you're saying. That it depends on
the previous years. And that's why people are so confused about looking at their 401ks, looking at what's happened in them. And they're thinking that the market has done so well because they've been hyping up for the last 10 years how great it's done, right?
Right.
Phenomenal. From 2010 to 2020, we've had the market go from 880 or so on the S&P, almost 800 to 3,200. So it's a 400% rise in the stock market. And the compounded rate of return has been about 13% a year compounded. Mm-hmm. And you got to be thinking, wow, why don't I see that in my 401k?
But why wouldn't you? If you had a 401k and you just stayed with it during all those years, why wouldn't you see that?
Well, because your 401k peaked at double that in June of 2007, roughly. And so you got cut in half, which means the market has to go up 100% just to break even. Mm-hmm. And that took you all the way to basically 2013. So from 2009 until 2013, four straight years, while they're hyping up how great the market's doing, you haven't even broken the
gains,
even yet.
Yeah, it was making the gains back from what it was before.
Exactly. And so rather than a 400% return, what really happened is it went from basically 1,500 to 3,000. It doubled once.
Got it. I get what you're saying. Yeah.
So it sounds really different compounded rate of return.
Yeah. Yeah. In sort of absolute money. Yeah.
Yep.
That makes sense.
Absolute money. If you'd been in the S&P 500, you would have doubled your money since 2007. Right. Yeah. So you're looking at 13 years. You doubled once, which means you're averaging in 13 years, you're averaging about 5.5% compounded. Plus you got some dividends in there. So let's give you 6% compounded or so. And, that's nothing to write home about. And yet this is being hyped up as one of the greatest decades in the stock market ever.
Well, maybe it still is.
I suspect. Oh, there was another really interesting Shiller chart.
Oh my gosh, we are never going to get to checklists, are we? We teed it up. We hyped it up. Maybe we just start checklists next time because I want to hear what the really interesting Shiller report said.
Okay, well, Robert Shiller did created the Shiller cyclically adjusted PE ratio and produced a chart which basically explained why you may have not have done well in the stock market at times when you thought you were doing it should have done better. And that the current stock market is vastly overpriced on a historical basis. Okay. So and by the way, he won the Nobel Prize in economics for that, among other things. And so this is not a lightweight guy. He's a professor at Yale. And he produced a document not too long ago that compared the cyclically adjusted rates of return in the stock market since I think 1950. So how you had done over any 10-year period of time, So 50 to 60, 51 to 61, and so on. Compared to the percentage of equity that the general public has of their equity invested in the stock market. So let's say...
that one more time.
So if you have $100,000 and you invest $70,000 of it in the stock market,
okay,
you have 70% of your total investable capital in the stock market.
Okay.
All right. And if you have $100,000 and you have $40,000 invested in the stock market, you have 40% of your investable capital in the stock market.
Okay.
All right. And this chart is magnificent. It basically shows that as people put more and more of their investable capital in the stock market, approaching 60 to 70% as a general population, the stock market rates of return go down towards zero. In other words, the more people who think the stock market is a good place to put money, the worse the next 10 years are going to be.
Because he's using the 10-year moving, rate of return?
Yeah, it's just 10-year average cyclically adjusted, basically. So okay. Just the 10-year average return adjusted for inflation.
Because if it were compared to that year, I think it would have to be over multiple years the way he did it in order for that to be the outcome. Because if it were in that year, then the more people that put money in the stock market, the more money that goes into the stock market will cause... They're buying stocks, so that's going to cause prices to rise in general.
But yeah, you'd think, right? But then next following 10 years, what happens? So then, and that's the question.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
So we don't know what's happened since 2010 or 11, I guess, at this point. We're on the 10-year cycle of 2011 to 2021. So we don't have that data.
Oh,
point.
Like he went with round decades, moving 10 year.
No, it just happens to be, we're on 2011 because he's got the data in. Oh, no, he doesn't. He has the data in for 2010 through 2019, but I don't think it's published it yet. It's pretty new.
Yeah.
So I'm sure we've got 2009 mm-hmm. to 2018.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that 10-year cycle. So we've got all the ones before that, all the way back into the 1950s. And it turns out there's an absolute correlation, or should we say it's absolutely opposite of correlation. It's a perfect correlation. When you get up to 60 to 70% of the population investing, 60 to 70% of equity invested in the stock market, your next decade of returns are below 5%. And we're there now. That's the point, is that we are very near the peak, most ever percentage of equity invested in the stock market.
Like this year, you mean? This is not according to his chart, because you said the chart only goes up to 2011.
Yeah. So probably the last 10 years have been pretty good, because it was very low in 2008 and 2009, right? People had pulled their money out of the market. And indeed, we had very high returns. But this year, we're back up now. After 10 years, we're back up to a peak, which implies that it says if this chart has been correct for the last 80 years or 60 years, then we're going to have very low returns in the stock market for the next 10 years and subsequent, probably until we have a stock market crash or a recession and we start to see people take their money out of the market, in which case, once the money's out of the market, then we're going to have awesome returns again.
Which corresponds rather
closely to what we do with our investing.
Does he explain his own interpretation of that data?
Not that I've seen.
Okay. I'd be curious what he thinks that means.
So look, check it out. Check it
out. Yeah. Okay. So this is...
I haven't seen that before.
Shiller from Yale.
Yep.
And it's a new chart.
Comparing
level of investedness.
Equity percentage in the market. Something like that.
Yeah.
Right?
Essentially, because what strikes me is it's kind of a level of, it's not 100%, so I'm going to use air quotes, but being fully invested, like most normal people would balk at putting more than, let's say, 70% of their investable assets in the stock market. And so I wonder if maybe that's kind of the tipping point, is where people feel like, okay, I'm fully invested now, I'm not going to put any more money in.
think that's likely since it's never gone over that.
Right. So the only place from there is I'm going to take money out because I'm not going to put any more money in.
Right. And people do that, of course, when the stock market crashes, but they don't do it before it crashes. They do it as it's crashing and after it crashes, right? They wait thinking it's going to turn around. It always has before in their experience, right? For the last 10 years, it's always turned around. And there's a lot of investors who are in your era, millennial era, who are now almost 40 years old, who are actually starting to be real serious about investors, and they've never seen a recession.
No, it's something I'm super conscious of that I have never, I mean, I've seen two recessions, but not as an investor. And it's something I'm really conscious of, that that's not an experience I've been through. It's not something that I really know in real life how that's going to go. And for me and my steadiness in life, my emotions, going through something in real life is really important to understanding what I need to get better at. So I fully anticipate that I'm going to do a lot of stuff wrong when that happens, even though I'm like trying to be as prepared as I can be. I think, you know, people who have been through it as investors have a real, and maybe, you know, maybe they get like too reactionary or, you know, they've got their own stuff. But as a newbie, it's definitely something that I wonder, you know, how is that going to go?
Well, you remember that joke I think I told you about the actor who got a bit part on Broadway?
No.
Where he got his speaking lines on Broadway, which is a big deal to get speaking lines on Broadway.
Sure.
And so he's just, you know, basically a spear carrier type actor.
That's well, a thing?
Yeah, I mean, just like you carry a spear in the Roman saga, right? You don't have a lot to do. Sir, a message from Gallipoli, right? Or whatever. You get one line. So he had one line, and it's like, hark, is that a cannon I hear?
Okay.
That's all he has to say, right? Come on stage. Hark, is that a cannon I hear? And like any struggling actor, you want to get it perfect, right? So he's practicing all the time. Hark, is that a cannon I hear? Hark, is that a cannon I hear? And so on opening night, you know, just as he's ready to do his part, the last lines before his come out, and then boom, and he goes, what the hell was that? Which is to the point.
Because he hadn't practiced it in real life.
Yeah, when it's real, it's very, very different. I mean, soldiers know this very, very, they take this to heart, believe me. You have That's all this funny. Training and training and training, and you got training with lasers, and you got training with soft bullets, and you got training with all kinds of stuff. And then when real bullets fly, when it's really major league stuff coming in with people trying to kill you, it's just completely different. Mm-hmm. And there's no substitute for it. And I think you're going to experience that. It's a little bit of war, a financial war, where you're experiencing this huge wave of emotions mm-hmm. that are not just yours. They're the emotions of the market.
Mm-hmm.
And you get tied into it. And it's very hard not to. And this is one of the great secrets of investing. The way we do it is to control your emotion by making sure you have big margins of safety in the companies you own and that you really understand those businesses and that you're comfortable that they're going to survive this downturn.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's really, I think, takes us to the point of this particular podcast, which was to start you off on our checklist.
But you know what? There couldn't be a better introduction, could there?
No.
This is why we need a checklist.
Boom! To control emotion. Got to do it.
But I don't like control emotion. I don't like that. I like...
Okay, what do you like?
Mastery of our emotions, being integrated with our emotions so that it's not...
Because you're not going to control your emotion.
No, and that's a really sort of messed up thing to do. That's going to hurt you in the long run. So we don't want to control our emotions. We want to experience our emotions, appreciate them, and understand that there can be ups and downs and lots of surface level stuff going on and still keep a clear head and knowledge of what we choose to do and the actions that we take.
Or as clear a head as we can.
as we can.
And let our training kick in.
Agreed.
Right. And yes. So this will be important to our training. Now we're going to go through this pretty carefully, and this has never been published. And I think that this is just one person's view of this. Okay.
When you say this, what are you talking about?
These checklists that I'm going to reveal.
That you're going to tell us about.
Yeah.
So these are different, or this is a different checklist than the one that we put in our book, Invested. We talked about that last episode, that there were actually two kind of different-ish checklists in our book. Right. And now what Dad's going to show us next episode is a updated, better question mark? We don't know. We're going to discuss it. Checklist.
Yeah, we'll discuss it. I mean, it, as we said last time, it's really a key thing about checklists is that they be the right length.
Yeah.
About the right things. And mm-hmm. You probably never get it perfect, or you maybe never even get it really right. But it's very important that in the emotion of the moment that you have the right checklist, and it's not so long that you can't really use it. You know, you can't find it or you can't use it. So this is certainly not perfect. It's one shot at it. And we do use it. We use it every single company we look at as we get deeper into it. We don't use it initially, particularly. We just crank on the surface level until we have determined that this is interesting enough and it's not too hard and we like it and we want to get deep into it. Then we start to apply the checklist. And I will say, very few people will reveal their checklists. That becomes, you know, pretty proprietary stuff. But I want you guys to realize that my checklist maybe won't work for you necessarily, but it's a good model and of a type of way of looking at the market that it works for us.
Yeah, well, and that's what matters. It works for you. And each one of us then will take that info and we'll see if it works for us. Okay, so that'll be next time. Talk to you then. Thanks, everybody.
Okay, man. I guess that's it. We're locked in now. We're gonna have to do it. I have a little feeling of trepidation about putting this out there, but
I understand. Okay. I understand that. Maybe you're allowed. You're allowed to take things out if you want and. And
I might change my mind between now and next week.
Okay, you can think about it.
I'm going to think about it. Having hyped this up. All right, we'll see.
Next week we'll be like, so we're going to talk about...
We'll talk about what's going on with Tesla. Other guys' checklists.
What's happening with Tesla lately? Tesla. Yeah, let's talk about that. Nobody's been talking about that.
Yeah. All right, until then, time to go play. See ya.
Bye.
Bye. Hi guys, thanks for listening to Invested. If you enjoyed this episode and you want more information, including show notes and more episodes, visit us at investedpodcast.com. There's a special offer waiting for podcast listeners to attend my 3-day investing workshop absolutely free. So just head to investedpodcast.com. Everything discussed on this podcast is either my opinion or Danielle's opinion, and is not to be taken as investing advice, because I am not your investment advisor, nor have I considered your personal situation as your fiduciary. This podcast is for your entertainment and education only, and I hope you enjoyed it.